All right, let's begin, and let's just do a quick sound check. So if you can hear me speaking, please type in the chat box, or you can use the hand icon in the task pane that you have in GoToWebinar, and please raise your hand or let us know that you can hear us.
Wait, 3 minutes
and we will begin. So let's see. Yes, all right. So it looks like the sound is coming clear, so we can begin. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. My name is Michelle Balorchi, and I am an outreach and recruitment specialist with the Fulbright Scholar Program based at the Institute of International Education. And I'm joined by several colleagues today. If we could go to the next slide. Angelica Cerna, who's also a program officer at the Institute of International Education. And also the Fulbright Commission in Canada, we have Paolo. Paolo, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Michelle, and all the IIE team for inviting me today. My name is Paolo Carvalho, and I work at the Fulbright Canada office looking into the recruitment component of our programs. So probably some of you might have received some email from me, and I will be talking a bit about our awards throughout this presentation.
Wonderful. And we also have what I'd like to call a distinguished alumna of the Fulbright Scholar Program to Canada, Jessica Shoemaker. So, Jessica?
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to get to talk a little bit about my experience in Canada. I was the research chair in Aboriginal Legal and Resource Rights at the University of Alberta from 2018 to 2019. But right now I'm home in Nebraska, where I'm an associate professor of law at the University of Nebraska. And thanks for having me.
Wonderful. So today's webinar focuses on Fulbright Scholar opportunities to Canada. So this is geared towards academics, professionals, researchers, independent scholars who are looking to teach and research in Canada. And there's several opportunities that we're going to be going through today. For those of you who are joining us that have recently graduated from college or recently completed a master's program, we ask that you take a look at the opportunities through the Fulbright Student Program. That's where you'd probably be a better fit. The program today is open to academics and researchers and professionals with several years of experience. So what I'll do at this point is ask everyone, we can turn off our webcams and go straight to the presentation, and thank you all for joining. And if you have questions throughout the presentation, please chat them into the question box and we'll be happy to take them. All right, so moving right along to the mission and history of the program, Fulbright is proud to gear up to celebrate its 75th anniversary next year. So we have been working around the world with partner countries. We have 160 countries that we've partnered with to make this program possible. And it's open to students and researchers, administrators, and professionals from all fields to study, teach, or conduct research. And the mission of the Fulbright program is really at the core of bringing people together and fostering mutual understanding. Ultimately, we hope that the program improves lives around the world. And I think whenever I speak to alumni, I really do feel that we fulfill this every day when we work on this program. The Fulbright program was established. The Fulbright program was established in 1946 by an act of Congress, and it is the flagship international exchange and cultural exchange program. Along with funding from the U.S. Department of State, we have several countries that partner with us in co-funding the program, and there are several host institutions that also contribute to the program. The Institute of International Education administers the program on behalf of these sponsors. Okay, so in terms of diversity inclusion, this is actually a very important piece of the program's outreach and recruitment strategy. This statement comes from the Department of State, and we really try and be sure to include people from all backgrounds, institutions of all types, whether they're community colleges, Research One institutions, tribal colleges, minority-serving institutions, and try and include grantees and Fulbrighters that really reflect the depth and the breadth of U.S. society. So this program is open to everyone who is eligible, and we try to ensure that the message is that while the program is prestigious and elite, it is not elitist. So certainly diversity and inclusion is at the heart of everything we do. All right, so in terms of the numbers, just to give you an idea, the Fulbright program has several programs within it. So in terms of Fulbright in general, there's about 8,000 awards annually that IIE administers. Today, specifically, we're talking about the Scholar and Administrator program, and the opportunities to Canada are open to scholars and professionals. So there's about 800 opportunities annually that are available through this program. And in terms of the baseline eligibility for the scholar program, U.S. citizenship is required. After that, it really depends on the award description. So if we have time in the presentation, I'd like to walk you through an award description. But essentially, that is really going to be the kind of the benchmark for what you're looking at in terms of what's required in terms of degree or teaching experience, research experience, all of that. And if you have had a Fulbright Scholar grant in the past and you're looking to reapply to the program, we ask that you wait 2 years from the time your grant ended to the time that you reapply. All right, so diving right into the opportunities in Canada, and we have Jessica featured on this slide as well with her kids. So Canada has a large offering of awards. It's one of our larger programs within Fulbright Scholar. There are 18 unique award offerings that offer about 50 grants. So you'll hear me use the terms award and grant kind of almost interchangeably, but there is a subtle difference. The award might have more than one grant, more than one spot. So you'll see with 18 awards, there's up to 15 spots. So for example, the postdoc award might have, that would not be good. The Carlos Rico Award has two. The research chairs have up to four per topic. So that's how that works. There are also multi-country opportunities available. So if you're interested in conducting research in Canada, as well as another country, let's say Mexico, that's one of the offerings, that's possible. There's also an Arctic award we'll be getting into. And the nice thing about Canada is that there's a lot of flexibility in terms of placements and disciplines sought. So really, if you have an idea of a project, most likely it'll be able to take place in Canada. And also, they're very open in terms of who can apply. Academics of all levels, including postdoctoral applicants. So we refer in the program to postdocs as those that have received their PhD within the last 5 years. So if you fall into that category, you would be eligible for a postdoc or an early career award. The other great thing is that, as you saw Paolo in the beginning, the Fulbright Commission in Canada is a binational entity that is based in the capital in Ottawa, and they are there to assist you with placements, with the orientation, any kind of support that you need in country. All of that kind of thing is administered. There's a dedicated staff based in Canada to assist and work with Fulbright scholars. And then as well, kind of in-country, in-grant opportunity, once you're already on your grant, you can apply for the regional travel grant. And Jessica will be speaking a little bit about that later and what that meant for her and where she was able to go. And then last but not least, I wanted to feature this because it's brand new in the awards catalog, the Fulbright Canada Pierre Elliott Trudeau Fellowship, which is a unique opportunity for public policy experts to reside in Montreal, to be at the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation and collaborate with researchers and guide young scholars. So Paolo will be sharing a little bit about that in the next slide. If you'd like to visit the Fulbright Canada Commission website, I've added the link at the bottom. It's fulbright.ca, and you can read more about the commission and the other opportunities there. All right, so moving on to some of the awards that Canada has to offer, there are several awards that are called research chairs. And these actually allow you to teach as well as research, or if you'd like, you could simply conduct research. As you can see, there are 12 unique opportunities, and they've listed, they're kind of topic-wise, discipline-wise, and if your research area doesn't fall into any of these, then you have one that is open to any field, the field open research chair. So for all of these, you will notice in the awards catalog, there are specific host institutions listed based on the particular discipline. Right. So if you are in arts and humanities culture, you would have a few set of host institutions listed. And they would be different if you were in education or environmental studies. And the thing about these awards is that they really do match you up with the appropriate host institution. So Jessica's going to speak a little bit about it later, but in her field, which is very kind of a very specific niche kind of field, it made sense that she was based at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. So that kind of situation, those kind of partnerships and placements, the commission can assist in. With the exception of the Field Open Award, the letter of invitation is optional. And again, the Fulbright Commission in Canada will work to place you at the appropriate institution. You are welcome to reach out to different hosts based on the list of hosts are displayed in the awards description. But again, the letter of invitation is absolutely optional. For most of these research chairs, there's about 3 awards available. So as you can see, there's already quite a good number, about 36 spots in these research chairs. And again, even though they're called chairs, they are open to early career level academics. So it's not required that you be a senior scholar. Early career academics are also welcome to apply. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Paolo, on this one?
Yeah. So just to reiterate on what you mentioned, our research chair are predetermined opportunities that exist with universities throughout Canada. So Canadian universities do recognize the value of having U.S. scholars, of having collaborations with U.S. scholars, and this is a wonderful opportunity to undertake either exploratory or new projects with Canadian colleagues, or to expand on further collaborations that you may already have in Canada. The idea behind this award is that during usually one term, so most of these awards are for one term, the U.S. scholar comes to Canada and works directly with colleagues from Canadian institutions. And by institutions in here, all of these are predetermined opportunities, but most of them are, and all of them in this case are universities. But for example, for the traditional award, you can apply to any institution from Canada that does research in your field. And the good thing is that you don't need a letter of invitation for most of these awards. So the field open is the only one for which you will need a letter of invitation. But all the others you can apply without one. So we recognize that in some cases you may not have previous connections, and that's perfectly fine. If by any chance you would like to get in touch with the colleagues at the Canadian university that is hosting the award, you can get in touch with our office, and we will try to assist you in establishing a first contact. So that's basically what I have in mind for this slide.
Great, excellent. Yes, so altogether there's about 36 spots, 36 grants combined for all of these. So if you have any questions, feel free to email me, or you can also reach out to Paolo. We'll give all of the contact information at the end of the presentation. I can also chat that in right now. But certainly the best place to start would be looking at the awards listed in the catalog. So moving on to the next slide, the other opportunities we have, I've featured here. So if the awards for the research chairs are not in a particular, you don't find your host among those listed, then we do have the All Disciplines Award, where you can select the affiliation, you can select the host, and the flex option is available to that. for that. So the flex option allows you to conduct research over two or maybe three different visits across two academic years. So you would need to state in your project statement the need for a flex option. The letter of invitation is required for the All Disciplines Award, and that is a 4 to 9 month grant. So as Paola mentioned, the research chairs are typically 4 months, basically one semester. So if you need more time, then I would suggest the All Disciplines Award. Again, that one is open to all disciplines. So whereas with the research chairs, you're only competing with people in your field, the All Disciplines Award is open to all disciplines, so a project from array of disciplines. The other award we'd like to showcase is the Postdoc Award, and that is a placed award at the University of Northern British Columbia. That is a full academic year, 9 months, and so the postdoc grantee will have guidance, just you know, as if they were a postdoc anywhere else. So it's a very supportive program to be a part of, and there are different areas of interest that the University of Northern British Columbia has outlined along with the commission, so take a look in the award description. But it's technically open to all disciplines, but there are certain areas of preference where they'd like the scholar to collaborate with researchers there. And then moving on to opportunities for senior scholars, we have the Fulbright Canada Distinguished Research Chairs at Carleton University. So there are two four spots with this one at Carleton, and there are about five unique research areas. Again, this is open to senior scholars who are looking to do research. This is a full academic year. It's a 9-month opportunity, and if you'd like more information, you can find the description about the five research areas, but briefly they are arts and social sciences in Canada and North America, entrepreneurship is one cluster, environmental science, public affairs in North America, as well as scholarship of teaching and learning. So this would be a great opportunity for any of you who are in those fields and looking to partner with colleagues at Carleton. And then last but not least on this slide is the new award with the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation. It's the Fellowship Award, and they are looking for a senior scholar in public policy. So there are different opportunities every year, and this year the theme is on public policy. And what's unique about this award is there's a 4-month residency in Montreal, and then after that there's the 8-month collaboration that takes place remotely. So I would invite Paolo to speak a little more about this award. We've just unveiled it this week in the catalog, and I think it's very exciting. It's also a wonderful opportunity to be in Montreal. So Paolo, if you have anything else to add?
Yeah, for sure. So the Fulbright Canada Pierre Elliott Trudeau is a new award that we are including in the catalog for the first time this year. This award is meant to give the opportunity to U.S. scholars that are interested in particular themes that the foundation looks into every year. So this year, under their priorities, they have identified that they would like to receive applications for scholars that are interested in the theme of language, culture, and identity. Although they are a public policy foundation, they basically identify specific topics each year, and the award is offered based on the most recent topic that they are interested in. Like you mentioned, Michelle, the award comprises a visiting for 4 months that should take place either at the Pierre Trudeau Foundation office or a university in Montreal. So the way that they work is pretty flexible. So their office, for example, sits just beside McGill University. So if the person has an interest in exploring anything with colleagues at McGill, it may be possible to sort of shift their work between the office and McGill or any other university in Montreal. Afterwards, the collaboration is supposed to be extended for a total of 1 year. However, the person is not required to be on site for more than 4 months. So the goal is that if the person wants to go back to the U.S., they definitely can go back to their home institution, and they will be entitled to a further financial support for any travel that might happen during that 1 year period. So that money can be used to offset costs of travel, costs of attending events. So it's a somewhat different grant than the traditional research share, but once again, it's meant to foster the collaboration between U.S. scholars and Canadian scholars.
Great. And then moving on to the next slide, the last couple of awards that we'd like to feature. These are the multi-country opportunities. If you have research projects that involve Mexico as well as Canada, we have the Fulbright Carlos Rico Award for North American Studies. And this is, again, open to all disciplines that relate to the trinational collaboration between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. This is a 4 to 10 month grant opportunity, and the scholar is expected to spend equal amount of time in both Canada and Mexico. So if you're doing 4 months, you would be 2 months in Mexico, for example, or 2 months in Canada, back to back. So it depends on where you'd like to start, but we ask that the grant take place kind of consecutively. Host institutions don't necessarily just have to be universities. If your project involves working with a research institution or think tank or a government agency, those institutions are welcome as well. You will need to provide letter of invitations, or it's preferred that you provide letter of invitations from both institutions to speak about the feasibility and the suitability of the project. So anything that relates to all three countries, this is a wonderful opportunity to be able to do that research under the umbrella of the Fulbright Carlos Rico Award. And then the other one that is, it's not new, but it's new this year. So the Fulbright Arctic Initiative is in its third, let's say, third cohort that we're seeking. It's an award opportunity that's actually quite unique, and I think it speaks very well to Fulbright's mission of bringing people together from different countries through research and education. And I'm going to allow Paolo to elaborate a little bit more, but this is something that it's only open to Arctic Council member countries. So Canada and the U.S. are part of that. So would you like to expand a little more, Paolo?
Yeah, for sure. It's a very interesting program, because like you mentioned, it brings together countries that have this interesting or this common interest in the Arctic. So obviously Canada is one of these countries, because of obviously its geographical location, and then also countries from northern Europe and also Russia are part of this initiative. So if you have an interest in working with colleagues from different countries under a common topic of the Arctic, this is an excellent program. So the program runs for 18 months. Because of the current situation that we're dealing with, the program is set to start a bit later than usual. So the applications are open until September 15, and the program will start next year. And it's meant to be a combination of on-site and online activities, because obviously we realize that the scholars are not able to spend 18 months away from their home institution. This program enables for an exchange component, but most of the work is done online or via short seminars and conferences that participants are asked to come together. In terms of the opportunities in Canada, if there are U.S. scholars interested in which Canadian universities could be eventual good options for the exchange, they can reach out to our office and we can definitely provide some insight into some options.
Great. All right. So let's move on then to introducing our alum again and having her share about her experience. Thank you, Professor Shoemaker, Jessica, for joining us today. And could you speak a little bit about your path to Fulbright and your experience in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again so much for having me. Listening to all of these opportunities, honestly, I'm sitting here wishing I could just apply again because it was such a profoundly productive but also just delightful year for me professionally, but also these pictures of my kids remind me just what a lovely year my kids had in Canada as well. So I want to be responsive and I'll just sort of give general comments about, just as an example, what my project looked like, and then hopefully can answer questions and be useful, because I know when I was at this stage, I had a lot of practical questions about how things worked. But as you can see from the slide, I actually did extend my visit so that I was there at the University of Alberta for almost the full year, for the full term. And I was doing a project that was specifically looking at Indigenous land tenure and land reform more specifically. So I should just back up and say that I'm a law professor and a legal scholar. My work in the United States is focused on the federalized property land tenure rules that apply in the modern U.S. Tribal government reservation space, so in formal reservations, really federalized property system that exists there, which is notoriously complex and problematic with lots of economic and cultural and self-determination consequences for tribal governments and tribal sovereignty in the United States. And although I've spent a lot of years, or a few years at least, I feel like I'm still fairly junior, but I've spent what time I've had of my career trying to kind of work out the challenges of the U.S. system and more importantly, possible Indigenous-led reforms and pathways to property reform. Canada, for me and for the work that I do, provided a really ideal kind of natural experiment space where the legal systems and in particular the legal federalized property systems on reserves for First Nations in Canada have a lot of similarities to the U.S. system. So similar related modern laws, similar related colonial histories. But Canada has really diverged from the United States, as I'm sure everyone on the call knows, in a much more active and dynamic process towards reconciliation and land-based reconciliation specifically. And what that means on reserves is that First Nations in Canada, although in the U.S. we've tried some kind of narrow reforms, in Canada there were some sort of what seemed to me as a U.S. scholar looking north, much more a dynamic, potentially transformative and exciting legal reform potentials. And so I came to Canada really to learn from the Canadian experience and see what, if anything, we could translate to U.S. legal reforms or legal reform possibilities. And so my research project just very briefly had two steps. I did a kind of deep comparison at the federal level of U.S. and Canadian legal systems on reservations and reserves and specifically property-based reforms. And then I did a second stage project, which was looking at the actual land codes or land laws that tribal governments in the United States and First Nations in Canada were adopting within these different reform regimes, and had big questions about what we can learn from these comparative experiences about how property evolves or changes over time, if it does, and deeper questions about the potential and the reality of big ideas like legal pluralism and especially pluralistic relationships to property and land. And so that project that's what I spent my research time in Canada working on. It was extraordinarily fruitful. I learned lots of unexpected things. It was productive. I've written some early kind of parts of the project up, but I actually have research assistants still working on the questions that evolved and grew out of my experience there. So it was just very fruitful and inspired a lot of new research trajectories for me. And I'm sure, you know, I'm happy to talk about kind of any of this, but I would say, you know, there's really no substitute for me for the experience of just being there in person, meeting colleagues, talking to people who were involved in land reforms, just the kind of rigor of the conversation and the tenor of the conversation and the commitment was just totally different. And I learned and grew so much from the year that I honestly wish I could do it again. So Michelle, I don't know if that's a helpful start. I'm happy to talk about more or less of any of that.
Sure. Sure. No, I'd like to hear a little bit about what your interactions were with students, because you were on a research grant, so kind of how that worked, and then you also had gone on the regional travel grant, and that seemed really exciting. If you could share a little bit about how that worked and how you selected that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So my research, my grant was 100% research, so I wasn't formally teaching in any way while I was there, which, although I love teaching, was actually, you know, a fabulous chance to just focus on the scholarship. But I did have a lot of interaction with students, actually, so I think I did, you know, 10 or so lectures or presentations. Some of those were faculty level workshops, but a lot of those were either public lectures or meeting with students in different universities. So both at the University of Alberta, and then I also, you know, helped at a legal history seminar at the University of British Columbia, sat in on a history class at Augustana College, just south of Edmonton, and sort of met with students informally and then as kind of a guest speaker in various classes. And that was super fun. I find students energizing all of the time, so I sort of looked for those interactions. But the other kind of big interaction I had with students was actually through the regional travel grant, which I think we called the Visiting Speakers Scholar Speaker Program or something during my year. And basically, this is an opportunity where when you're in country during your award, you do a short application and the commission provides some funding to support regional travel within Canada. And so I actually applied for and received funding to travel to Nunavut. This is actually me, that picture of me looking cold but very happy at the top of the slide is me in Iqaluit, Nunavut, where I traveled specifically to meet with students as part of the Nunavut Law Program, which is basically its innovative legal access program in which the law school is literally brought to students in Nunavut. A lot of Inuit, but also non-Inuit students who are in Nunavut, and providing kind of an opportunity to address some of the access to justice and the need for more lawyers in the north. So I went there specifically to meet with those students, and I did some lecturing on both reserve property systems and what they would call the South, which, you know, Canada north to us, but in southern Canada, and then also in the U.S. Reservations. But, I mean, I cannot emphasize enough how much, you know, I might have given a little bit in that lecture, but I got so much more out of that experience while I was in Iqaluit. Of course, you know, met with my colleague who was there teaching property law, and I was her guest and got a tour of the area. Met with a cultural advisor to the program who was working on climate change and cultural property issues, including with the UN. Met with the people who, or at least some of the people who had been firsthand involved in the land claim negotiation, which of course is, you know, fairly very recent in kind of the span of time as we think about law reform in the Arctic, so the process of that land claim negotiation. And then actually a couple of students from the class, this is what the picture is from, just took us out on the ice. We got to go far from Iqaluit and be, you know, just on the ice in Nunavut, and it was so amazing. It was really one of my, you know, top, I'm not exaggerating when I say, like, top most memorable and impactful life experiences, really. And as a person who studies property, you know, being in Nunavut where the land itself is extremely different, much less people's relation to it and organization around it, was just very, very important, and something I still kind of reflect on and think about.
That sounds really amazing. I actually had to do a little search there to see exactly. So where exactly were you? Were you when you went to Nunavut? Was that at a university or college, or where was that?
Yeah, so I actually I went to Iqaluit, which is the sort of bigger but still very small city, I guess, town. But it was the Nunavut Law Program, which is actually currently being hosted by the University of Saskatchewan out of facilities at, I think it's Nunavut Arctic College. They have a small college building there, facility there.
Wow, that sounds really exciting. It is very geographically kind of remote and sparsely populated, so very interesting experience. Jessica,
yeah.
We have some questions for you that came in.
Okay. So
it says, what kind of cultural exchange opportunities did you participate in as a part of Fulbright? So I think this regional travel grant was one of them, but was there anything additional? And Paolo, maybe you can also speak to, I know there was an orientation, Jessica, you had mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can answer that quick, and then obviously Paolo, jump in. So of course, you know, this experience of going to Nunavut was a major cultural exchange experience for me. I also, you know, traveled elsewhere in Canada while I was there, and then just went to a lot of community events and tried to really engage myself in the community where I was in Edmonton. But I would say that the kind of main kind of formalized Fulbright other exchange opportunity or experience was the orientation that Michelle mentioned, which was in Ottawa early in the grant. And it was so well organized and lovely. So it was a convening of both students and scholars who had various awards that year, which that was just really fun to get to meet lots of people who are doing lots of really interesting things in different places in Canada. But also, you know, I really learned a lot about Canadian history and Canadian culture and government during that orientation, in part from things like an Indigenous walk through Ottawa with an Indigenous interpretation of markers in the city, a tour of Parliament. We went to some really impressive museums, but I really did feel like I came away from that with a valuable, you know, introduction to Canada. I learned that hockey is really hard. We played hockey. and I also did some of my own kind of personal stuff while I was there, like meeting with a Supreme Court justice and finding out more about the court system. And I'll stop talking to let Paolo talk, but I would also just say that I did bring my children with me, and I think, and I'm happy to talk about that more if there's interest in that, but that was probably our biggest cultural experience as a family, was that my kids experienced a very different public school system, a different community, and that really, you know, outside of the professional connections, was really one of the most valuable parts of the experience for me.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, Jessica. Sorry, if I can just add some elements, Michelle. One of the things that we always try to do in terms of the welcoming the U.S. colleges to do the orientation in September. So the logic is that we bring everyone, or at least the people that are able to attend to Ottawa, and we, throughout a couple of days, we engaged in a series of activities that are meant to make people get to know each other, talk about the projects that they will be taking, and also have a chance just to relax and do some fun activities. One of the things that I think it's probably relevant to touch base is that Canada it's a very multicultural country. So even a U.S. scholar might think that coming to Canada is a bit of the same. Maybe that's not the case. The fact that you are in a Canadian university, you will be. In contact with colleagues from all over the world, and the fact that the Canadian culture is pretty different than what you might find in the U.S. also makes it for a rich and diverse experience, and probably some people were not expecting. So that's just something that I would just like to add.
Great. No, that's wonderful. We have a couple more questions that came in. For you, Jessica, somebody asks, what steps does one take to meet with and make presentations to members of Indigenous communities? So how did that work with you?
So I actually might not be the best person for that question, because I actually thought a lot about how to be, from my own personal choices, to be a respectful researcher and not sort of overextend myself in my kind of initial just trying to be a learner, and not kind of force myself in places where, you know, maybe I didn't have as much to add or as much, it was more for me than for anyone else. And so I actually intentionally did my research and designed my research around primary legal sources, so looking at the actual land codes and the actual federal laws, and then spent my kind of connection building time, workshops and presentations and things, working with a lot of Indigenous scholars, but other scholars and other people who were working on these in the kind of these issues in kind of either an academic or a practitioner sense. And I just kind of tried to let that happen organically. And so I did get to meet a lot of people and have a lot of really transformative kind of one-on-one conversations. But I approached it, my own personal choice was just to approach it in a very kind of deferential, respectful way and not kind of force myself into any place unless I was invited first. I didn't design my project so that I needed to do that. And I think that worked well for me, especially as a non-Indigenous person, an outside scholar. That was just what I wanted to do. But I do know, you know, there were other scholars, Fulbright scholars my year, who I talked to often, who had really successful projects where they did do either qualitative or other sorts of studies or collect data from Indigenous communities directly or from Indigenous peoples, and they just had the methodologies and expertise that I didn't to do that. So I'm sorry I'm not super more helpful on that front.
No problem. I think it's going to be unique for everyone, but there are certainly ways to approach different communities. But let's see, we have some more questions that have come in. Paolo, this person has a question about contact. They said they emailed earlier this month looking for a contact and was told to get in touch with someone at the institution. I don't know if they emailed the commission or the host, but it says, is there a possibility of getting the name of someone to contact instead of cold calling somebody? How should we do this? Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. So for every host institution, we usually are able to provide one primary point of contact that could basically guide the person internally in terms of either gathering more information on the award or reaching out to potential colleagues that could be suitable for a joint project. However, what we always try to encourage is before getting in touch with the host institution, it's always good to have a general idea of the department that it's offering the award. And if that's not clear in the award description, they can reach out to us and we will assist them, so that they can have an idea of the profile of the faculty members of that department or of the research center that it's hosting the award, so that when they reach out to the host institution, they already have at least a general idea of what they might expect in terms of potential partnerships there. But definitely they can reach out to us and we will assist them the best we can.
Excellent. Okay, great. So would it be okay then, Paolo, for people to contact you directly if they haven't had any luck getting answers from the host institutions?
Yes. So the only thing that we are not able to do is when it's for the traditional award, because we don't have primary points of contact there. So we only have points of contact for the research chairs.
Okay, so I'm just going to be chatting in the info at fulbright.ca so everyone
yes.
can see, we can have that in there. Okay, all right, so there it is. And it's also listed in the award description as well. So, all right, so let us see if there's more questions. Yes, we've gotten a few more. So, Paolo, I'll let you kind of maybe take a stab at this one, but I can also start by giving my feedback. So the question is, do you recommend sending a mini proposal to one of you to get feedback? So what I would say is, actually the best people to take a look at proposals would be the host institutions, also your colleagues who are in the field. We actually don't have capacity to review proposals in advance, and of course in fairness of the competition we need to be fair to everybody who's applying. But Paolo, I don't know, what's the status, what's the stance of the commission? Are they okay if they send them to you, or should they really only be negotiating with the host?
Yeah, pretty much like you mentioned, Michelle. At the office, we are not able to be providing feedback on individual proposals, just for the sake of, in most cases, they come from very different fields, and we are not able to judge on the relevance or just which edits would be helpful for that particular proposal. One of the things that, like you mentioned, one of the things that eventually can be a very good way to approach this is, if the person already has a point of contact that's at the host institution in Canada, they could definitely write a sort of a proposal that is already being with input from colleagues from Canada. If that's not the case, if it's for a new project or if it's for a new collaboration, then definitely reaching out to colleagues in the US or in other countries that the person may know is also of value, in the sense that they can gather relevant input from colleagues in regards to their proposal. One other thing that I would recommend is the following, because they need to provide two references. It would be extremely helpful to always share the proposal with the references, either for feedback or also for some context, so that the references can write their recommendations. So that's another strategy.
Can I jump into something, Michelle?
Please do, yes.
Just in terms of one piece of advice that I got that was really helpful from people who had been successful in other Fulbright applications was, and you should tell me whether this actually helped or not, but I made sure I had people who were legal scholars like me look at my proposal, but also people in other disciplines. Because as I understand it, at least part of the peer review is an interdisciplinary review, and that having people outside of my discipline look at my materials was actually super helpful, because things that the law professor said, like, this is great, the hard scientist said, what are you talking about? What is this? And so it was helpful just to have those different audiences.
Yes, you took the words right out of my mouth. That's excellent advice, Jessica. We do encourage applicants to have both their peers in the discipline review the proposals, as well as those outside of their discipline, because it is an interdisciplinary review at the second stage. So the first stage is the peer discipline review, but certainly when it reaches the country review at that level, it's a variety of different people looking at it. Jessica, I have one last question before we dive into the other questions in the last few slides. Could you speak a little bit, and I know you got back last summer, and we've had COVID kind of interrupt our daily lives and projects, but could you speak a little bit about the impact and the outcomes of your project once you got back to Nebraska, once you got back to the university?
Yeah, it is true that, you know, I feel like I just got back and then the pandemic happened, which isn't really true, but things just have happened quickly. I've had a bunch of impacts. I mean, some of them are, again, I don't mean to just keep repeating myself, but the scholarship and the research and the conversations and the network that I built in Canada was just so fruitful, in the sense of meeting colleagues who worked on related but different issues but from different perspectives, a whole new literature, a whole new set of colleagues to sound off ideas with. And so it's really been fruitful for me just to, you know, change the trajectory of the kinds of questions that I'm pursuing in my own work. And so I feel that, you know, every day. I've also, you know, tried to bring back some of my experiences. We had various opportunities to, like, share it with students here at Nebraska, and of course some of those have been postponed now, but I still kind of look forward to doing that and bringing some of those international comparisons even into my teaching or my connections with students here. And then I'd also just say, you know, I've had, you know, these kind of this new network of colleagues from Canada, which, you know, it's so interesting because it feels, you know, similar and so close in some ways, but the experience was so different there. It was much more, it just opened my eyes to things that I hadn't thought about before, and a scholarship and a literature that I didn't know before. And so those conversations and connections have continued both formally and informally. So I have some formal research partnerships that have gotten some early funding to keep doing kind of international partnerships and comparisons on this kind of Indigenous land reform or Indigenous economics going forward. And then also just informally, you know, had really successful workshops and events and kind of convenings while I was in Canada, and those are, we're looking for ways to continue those and kind of keep those connections going, you know, just in informal conversations as well.
Great. So thank you, Jessica. That's really helpful. I think a lot of people think that, well, I've just got to think about what I need to propose to get the Fulbright, but certainly the Fulbright keeps on giving, so to speak, and there's a lot that you take away when you come back, and all the partnerships and collaborations that continue.
And so, honestly, my kids, too. I mean, my kids, if anyone's thinking about bringing families, my kids had a really beautiful experience that I think was, you know, transformative for them, you know, forever as well.
No, that's really great to hear. I do hear that often, that especially the ones that are kind of, you know, middle school, high school, they then, you know, start to, when they get to college, they want to pursue international careers or international relations, things like that. So it's getting them on that trajectory. So, great. So let's move on to the next slide. We just have a couple slides to wrap up, and then we have a few more questions. I know we're about 6 minutes out. I just wanted to showcase what the application components are. And for those of you, we're getting a couple questions from artists. So in addition to the application form and all of the things listed on the left-hand side, the project statement, et cetera, if you are an artist or coming from architecture, creative writing, et cetera, we do ask that you submit a portfolio. And then depending on if you're doing teaching or research or a combination of both, we would require you to submit 2 or 3 syllabi and a bibliography of up to 3 pages. So those requirements are outlined in the application. And then moving on, moving on to the next slide. The project statement is really going to be, I would say this along with the invitation, if you choose to get an invitation, these are really 2 key components in the application. The project statement is 3 to 5 pages, and this is really where you're going to demonstrate what you plan to do, how you plan to do it, why it's important, why you're the best suited to carry this out, if you're teaching, what courses you're teaching, and why, if you're going to be researching, what that research methodology looks like, what are the outcomes and impact, what is important about this research, and speaking about not only the impact at your host institution in Canada, but also what you plan to bring back, so to speak, when you come, return to the U.S., come back to your home institution. So what does that impact look like for you and both institutions? And then we do have supplemental questions in the application form that we ask why you're interested in Fulbright, the mission of being a cultural ambassador, things like that, why this particular country, and speaking about your adaptability. And then I wanted to just point out what the award looks like and where you can find out if an invitation is required, and if so, who to contact. So keep in mind that if you do receive an invitation letter, that it is a non-binding expression of interest. So again, there might be several Fulbright applicants requesting invitations from that particular university or department, and it doesn't mean that you are selected. It just is a good indication that they're interested in what you're proposing. Ideally, it should come from the person you hope to collaborate with, and it should be on letterhead. And to the best that they can, it should elaborate on what exactly you are proposing, how long you'll be there, kind of the timeline, who you'll be working with, and really most importantly, the impact and the importance of bringing you as a Fulbrighter to that host institution. So ideally, if you could go beyond the kind of boilerplate language, if they are offering you office space, have that included in the letter. If there's any other kind of contribution or support that the host offers, although it's not required, it's wonderful and we'd like to see that. So the letter should really be as detailed as possible. And you can find out on the second tab of the award description, it's the award requirements tab, if the letter is required and who to contact in that case. So let's go back to, we've just got a couple minutes, and if we could actually show the last slide, I believe we've got the contact, the last slide of the successful project. So I wanted to share just a sampling of recent projects that scholars have done in Canada and the different host institutions. So again, just to give you an idea of what has been successful in the past, and you can find out more in our Fulbright Scholar Directory on CIES.org. So we have a question, Paolo, maybe you can answer this one. Which awards would be best matched to artists? I know we have the research chair in arts and culture, but perhaps the field open or the all disciplines, what would you recommend?
Well, I always have a hard time answering questions like that because we offer so many awards that it's not easy to have a clear notion of which awards might be best for specific fields. But definitely the field open is an option because they welcome projects from different fields. In the arts and humanities, it might depend because some of those may be more geared towards indigenous. So if that's the case, if it's art related to indigenous, it's probably fine. If it's art just in outside of that, might not be suitable. But what I always recommend is for a more in-depth perspective of possible awards that might be suitable, I would encourage people to write to me because like that I can get a sense of their profile and advise them in a much more in-depth way than just what I can do right now. Yeah.
Great. All right. So I wanted to share the contacts here. If you'd like to ask questions about the application process or anything that just in general about Fulbright, please email me at westhem@iie.org. That's west as in western and hem for hemisphere, westhem@iie.org. The Fulbright Canada email I put in the chat box, info@fulbright.ca. And we have reached time for those of you, I think we just got to everything except just a couple, so please do follow up by email with your questions. And if you have questions that you think of after this webinar, please do contact us. This has been recorded. We will be posting it on our website. Check back maybe within a week for that if you'd like to get a copy of this presentation. And with that, I would like to thank our panelists. Thank you so much, Paolo from the Commission, Jessica from University of Nebraska for joining us, and my colleague Angelica. Thank you so much. I think this was a very informative webinar, and we look forward to receiving your application. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. All the best. And everyone, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.